You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing for Tacoma listeners, Joy Layden. Joy has 8 collections of poetry. Some of the titles: Impersonation, Transmigration, Fireworks in the Graveyard, Through the Door of Life. Presently, she is the Gottesman Chair of English at the Stern College of Yeshiva University. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you have a large Jewish population there, or is it mingled with secular students?
No, it's almost all Orthodox Jewish women. Some of them are moving deeper into Orthodoxy, some of them are moving away from it, but almost all of them have grown up in some kind of Orthodox Jewish family. And we have students from all over the world, so there is diversity, even within what sounds like a pretty homogeneous population.
So, in that regard, do you try to gear your poetry to the Judaic studies, or are you just playing it free over the whole realm of poetry when you teach?
Well, I'm hired in the English department, and because this is an Orthodox institution, they have pretty strict rules about who is allowed to teach what they consider sacred texts. So I am not authorized to teach Judaic studies. And it's not a great poetry reading population. The Orthodox Jewish culture, actually American culture in general, is not very big on poetry, but Orthodox Jewish culture, as I've experienced, is particularly alienated from poetry, although they're steeped in biblical literature and Psalms and, you know, really some of the great poetry. They don't think of it as poetry, and they think of poetry as a secular thing. So I mix in poetry with other subjects. It's the rare all poetry class that I've been able to teach. More interested in poetry writing, I would say, than poetry reading.
All right. Well, since we are sound poetry, it'd be a real delight to have you read one of your poems or two of them right off the bat. And if you wish to comment beforehand, that's fine, but I'd love to hear you read some of your work.
Do you have any requests, or would you like me to just pick something?
There is a poem called The Poem and Me, which would be, I suppose, quite appropriate to show a connection or a separateness, let's say.
The poem walks from me toward meaning that may or may not be there. By the time it returns, I'm someone else, though to the poem, which walks at relativistic speeds, no time at all has passed. That's why the poem looks so puzzled when it finds I've forgotten how we are related. The poem and I disappoint one another. Rather than mother and child, body and soul, we turn out to be one-night stands. The earth moved, my head throbbed, but when the poem returns many years later, it seems like nothing happened. I remember now how the poem began. I was looking out the window. It was winter, summer. There was a bird, or a memory of a bird, a screech. I suddenly heard a song, a pain that felt like explanation. I lay on the floor of the world, pieces of a toy, the poem began to play with. And that's from The Future is Trying to Tell Us Something, my new and selected poems.
Oh, so that is a recent one. Yes, I see that. The copyright says 2007, 2016 on that, but that's more recent than that. Yeah. Is that true? You sent this in early on when it was just a poem without it being collected into that work, to the storyscape.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I enjoy very much that idea of how the poet has to chase the poem. Do you feel sometimes that poem's more in charge than you are?
I would say when the poem is any good, one would always want that to be the case. So I would say that a poem that is no more than I am is not one that is going to stand the test of time, even necessarily of my own time. So something has to happen through me that makes the poem more than me. I think that's always what I would be after.
Yes. Well, that's right. You also have a wonderful way of bringing in a lot of animated nature in your poems, as many poets do, who actually are devoted somehow to the life in nature. But you yourself have written a poem that says, "Why I'm Not a Nature Poet," which I think is a great poem itself, because it has so much meaning packed in the denial of that. Would you read that one?
Yes. And this is from a collection called Fireworks in the Graveyard from Headmistress Press. And I have to preface it by saying one of my best friends, who doesn't identify as a poet, but she is one of the most marvelous writers about nature, just in her letters, far, far beyond my capacity. But she read this and she took great exception. She feels that I am a nature poet. And I'm like, well, not compared to, you know, what you're doing off the cuff there. But anyway, she lives in northern Wisconsin, so they have some serious nature going. This is called Why I'm Not a Nature Poet. I wish I knew the name of that bird. I wish I knew the name that bird keeps calling. I know it's a name, but I don't know the bird or the name it calls, or if birds call names, or whether the bird is calling or singing, or whether that name is my name.
Now, on the surface, that seems to be a rather simple poem of declaring that you don't know something. And yet memory is so important in the idea of poetry, the mnemosyne, right? The muse that actually infuses the poet with it. And so the bird calling, you think, does it matter what we name the call of the bird? I find myself not knowing a lot of birds, seeing them so quickly in flight, but I love to see the shape of the bird and the various coloration, but I can't tell people, oh, that was such and such, but I love it's the experience of seeing the bird. So you call, you don't know those things, but is there something that is somewhat enigmatic in this poem about the fact that it's is it calling or singing, or whether that name is my name? Is there something that you felt that was sort of special about the not knowing in that one?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that I really don't know the names of many things in the natural world. And I'm like you, I like watching birds go back and forth. But when you're, I'm not sure that would be a problem at all if I were a painter or a photographer. I don't think they necessarily have to know the names of stuff in order to represent it in their art. But if you are a writer and you don't know the names of parts of the natural world, it is indeed hard to refer to them. It's hard to evoke them except by saying something like the bird, which could apply to anything from a hummingbird to a condor. There are two words that I know. But that makes for a very different poem. Like, is it a hummingbird or a condor? So the fact that I'm not telling you should engender a little suspicion. But the not knowing, the question that the poem really raises is, and that you're raising, is there some kind of negative capability that comes from not having the nouns to fill in the blanks in this way? And I would say that the poem is hoping that this lack of language, this lack of specificity, opens for the possibility that even though I don't know the name of the bird actually knows my name. Although there's a question about whether I will be able to tell whether or not I'm being recognized by the world if I can't name it precisely.
Right, right. And so it does open this for a person to imagine all sorts of alien things, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It does, yeah.
And it keeps it in that unknown realm. I've been doing a little bit of, I've been doing acrylics and I've been doing it abstract. I'm not an abstract painter. Usually I do a bird. And somebody say, what bird is that? I say, well, I don't know. It's just a bird. It's got wings and a tail and a beak there. You see that? I couldn't quite tell you right now, but when I'm doing the abstracts, when I read some of your poetry, I thought, yes, doing this, this painting is directing me. I'm not directing it. It is beginning to show me where I have to go to find its direction or meaning, you know. And I don't want to say that it has a meaning in something definitive or identifiable because it's abstract. And it's a wonderful kind of not quite grasping what you're doing, but feeling sure that this is just right. This is good. Now, yeah, so the unknown leading you to perhaps something knowable, but still, it's going to be an experience. Yeah. So read another one, please.
Any particular kind of poem that you feel like hearing?
Choose any you wish.
Okay. All right. Well, Fireworks in the Graveyard, a lot of it grows out of a fairly intense and enlarging encounter with mortality. So I want to read one of the poems that came out of this. Actually, I'm going to read two. They're both short, and in the book, they're in reverse order. This one is called Moths, and it's seasonal because it's about what happens when with moths in autumn, at least in my neck of the woods. Moths don't fear me anymore. Settle at leisure on sink and shade. Row so slowly, the beat of their wings stirs the hair on my face. Each day is shorter, each sun less eager. It's the season of harvest, nuts and clusters, mushroom-haunted dawns and dusks, fattened calves, serious thoughts about fixing roofs and growing older. The light I longed for spirals closer, overflowing every facet of my compound eyes. So there was this place where I was getting to where I felt sufficiently in touch with dying and an aspect of living that as insects were starting to die around me, I was feeling a kinship instead of a distance from them. And this poem carries that a little bit further. It's called Plain Old Forever. Death Schmeth, been there, done that, conceived and aborted innumerable futures in a single breath. Eternity curves and recedes like a cheek I brush, highlighting the contour of the bone where being meets nothingness. Even forever has a flavor, invisible and sweet, like a small ripe fruit. Even nothingness creates a sensation, like a push-up bra maximizing cleavage between spirit and matter. I was fine while I lasted. I'm fine fading from lilac to black. I'll be fine when I stop shopping and sweating and slip into something more comfortable. Earth soft as a moccasin, plain old forever, sliding over my head like a cotton dress.
Mm. Yes, be comforted that way, yes. Feel that would be a comfort. Death is not a frightening thing for you, is it?
Well, it certainly wasn't in those poems. And I think in some ways I would say, no, it's not a frightening thing for me. And then in another way, I would say, I think my body has the same animal fear of dying that every other body has. I heard a marvelous interview on, I think it was with Terry Gross, Fresh Air. She likes talking with religious people and she likes talking with dying people. She struck gold. She had a priest who was dying. He was talking about getting a diagnosis and realizing he was ready. He was good to go. And he said, you know, if you're a clergy person, this is kind of like your final exam. It's where the rubber meets the road. Or have you really learned what you needed to learn and everything like that? And she said, oh, yeah. And he said, and then I got home and I told my wife and she said, you're ready, aren't you? Nobody else is. So don't kid yourself that you're getting off that easy. You've got a lot of work to do here because, yes. You know, we have definitely, we are not ready to let go of you.
Right. You'll learn that at home. Very good. And the modest proposal is an interesting one in that regard, with this idea about the play with life and death.
Yes.
Can you read that one? That one would follow very appropriately, I think.
Oh, yes. Thank you. So this is the one... where I get to refer in passing to Heidegger without knowing what I'm talking about. So that's an advantage of writing lyrics as opposed to writing academic essays. You can't really refer to Heidegger without reading Heidegger in an academic essay, but a lyric poem, nobody wants you to say very much. So a modest proposal, and this is from the future, is trying to tell us something also. Let's not kill or die today. Let's make angels out of yarn. Men of snow, mashed potato animals that smile as we spoon their eyes of melted butter. Instead of killing ourselves or one another, let's neatly stack anxiety's sweaters and scratch our itchy trigger fingers by whittling turtles for our mothers, or pretending to understand Heidegger, or imagining the sexual embrace through which time and space first conceived of matter. If we still aren't over killing and dying, we can search the stacks for library books that haven't circulated in generations and savor the mold that spores their spines, the way wine snobs savor the nose of vintage wines bottled between wars to end all wars. Look, we've played all day and haven't spilled a drop of blood apart from the occasional paper cut. In an hour or two, when it's very dark, let's make up stories out of stars and fill them with all the killing and dying we didn't do today, except in our imaginations. Let's pull our comforters over our heads and sing ourselves to sleep like good little civilizations.
Yes, the child at play too over such things. Although when you get to anxiety sweaters, it takes on a little more grown-up thought in a phrase like that, anxiety sweaters. But it is as though a child, a persona of children, deciding what to play and killing, dying. We played it a lot when we were kids. Did you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And the end of the poem suggests that human civilizations are still children, that we were still in a developmental stage. And I think that that's probably true. I think that our species is quite young as creatures go in this world. And it's not at all clear to me that we're going to make it to adulthood, but I think that's also true with children and adolescents. And you get to this point where, I don't know, they get driver's licenses and you're like, okay, I hope you're going to make it, you know, to the point where you're old enough to exercise forethought and things like that that will enable you to survive to adulthood here. I feel like our species is still in that pre-collective rationality and wisdom phase.
Sleeping, still asleep, not awake yet.
No.
The ambiguity, I think, is wonderful in those lines there. Singing ourselves to sleep like good little civilizations are sleeping still and not truly alive to the civilization. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I think we're in a time right now where many people are seeing the difference between those who are awake and alert to what must be done to help others in society besides yourself, keep yourself healthy, and those that are without concern, as though the invisible alien is not among us, that it doesn't exist really. It's like a God that you don't have to believe in. Yeah, or a devil that you don't have to believe in too. Yeah, either way. Yeah, so this poem really, really struck me as one that had a great deal of feeling about how we are, in a way, in charge of how we play with life and death, but how life and death are still there, and killing is definitely maybe a part of our lives.
Yes.
We practice it a lot when we were children, whether we were writing stories about it, and we were the hero saving somebody by killing somebody. But we see so much of this in film, in television, in novels. There is killing throughout our culture, in the media, but not always so much in poetry. I heard a teacher say, you're going to come in and read some poetry, but don't bring any death poetry. I'm tired of death poetry, and I don't think the kids would like it. And I thought, oh dear, well, I wonder if I should come.
Yeah, Emily Dickinson would have wondered the same thing.
Yeah, right, but I did. I went and I talked about other things besides actual dying. I used metaphors that were still close to it. So would you like to choose another one from your Fireworks in the Graveyard, which I think is a really great juxtaposition of lively, sparking stuff, and it's in the graveyard.
Yeah. Thank you. It's actually quite literal. I live in an area where people go to the local graveyard. It's just down the block. You know, in New England, there are a lot of small cemeteries here and there. And from it, you can see the town fireworks that are shot off from the state school that's nearby. And so people bring their kids. In a way, I'm thinking about, no, I'm going to read not that poem, because that's a little, it's not a hopeful poem. I'm going to read one that doesn't have death in it. I-95. So I-95 is the big north-south highway, connects where I live, you know, Connecticut, New York City. It keeps going down the East Coast. It's famous for traffic jams. Connecticut in general was basically invented so that cars wouldn't be able to move, I think. And it's quite good at its job. So this is called I-95. We're heading south, sun in our eyes, stuck in traffic, outdistanced by a dragonfly. No one's moving, but everyone will arrive. That's the nature of heaven and highways. That's the nature of time. The derrick hasn't stirred in days. The waves of the historic river stand frozen at the height of summer. Pieces of heaven are tumbling toward us, shards of sunlight igniting yesterday's puddles. We're moving now, rolling through space and time at many lives per hour. There's a village up ahead, a marina, a bridge, a flock of neatly nested condos, very exclusive, almost uninhabited, 1, 2, and 3-bedroom souls, most with river view, available for immediate occupation. The highway flows in both directions, toward love and away. God, a helicopter overhead, keeps an eye on everyone's speed, beating lazy blades.
Yes, very daunting as well as very moving down that highway. Good poem. That is definitely a travel poem, yes. To sit in traffic, there is much to experience still. But most people are just unhappy with being still when you're in a car that's supposed to go. Yeah.
Well, so, I am very cranky about traffic, but I was stuck in a bus, which is more luxurious than being stuck while you're driving a car.
Oh, if it's got air conditioning and it's the right kind of weather too. Yeah, that makes a difference. Well, there are experiences that we can all write about in motion on buses and so on. You wrote one about a bus driver who was contemplating at the Hegel's technology of the spirit. There is one that I felt was perhaps directing the student to consider something, but not perhaps as difficult as Hegel.
This is like the other poem. This is a commuting poem, and it's about commuting by. I don't know if you have Peter Pan bus out your way, but I spent a considerable part of my life on riding Peter Pan buses from Western Massachusetts to New York to teach, and always an adventure on Peter Pan. Never sure if your bus was going to get there. Pick you up, arrive on time. Sometimes they'd stop on the highway and the driver would say, oh, I'm not allowed to drive legally anymore, and just walk out. This is called Departure. The bus driver wedges Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit between dashboard and window. A girl chuckles. Lots of students on this route, a crowd that gets the joke. Hegel's dialectic ripens, synthesizing age and youth, eternity, and sweet September breeze. Now that my life is almost over, I wish I'd been better, more dialectical in my contradictions, like that tree over there, spinning light into sugar, or the girl exhaling dioxide as laughter, or the bus filling with unlived lives who have yet to learn that there is already here.
Yes. So was this an experience that you had? Did you think of this at some point on a bus with a group of people?
Absolutely. Yes, this was a Peter Pan bus picked me up in my area, which is a college town area. Yeah, although I'd never before since seen that. There was Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit. I remembered, I think it was exact same edition that I had driven myself crazy with when I was in college some decades before. And I am pretty sure that I saw the makings of a poem being handed to me right there. And so I jotted it down and came back to it sometime. And I would say it was easier to refer to Hegel's dialectic than to actually figure out what he was writing about it in the Phenomenology of the Spirit. This is part of that collection, which is Meditating on Mortality. About that Fireworks in the Graveyard book, not every poem is as light as that one is, but the vast majority of them are. There's a sense of mortality in them.
And when you have that departure there, that now that my life is almost over, I wish I'd been better, more dialectical in my contradiction. People do not have one life. We go through a career of changes, right, in our lives. And poets perhaps are aware of some of these demarcations. it makes you think, well, what's the life that's over? Have you just finished being a teacher, or have you just finished that and now you're going on to something else? But when you say, I wish I'd been better, well, better at that or life in general, is there a chance to still be better if there is a continuation of another persona, another life, another job, whatever it is?
Absolutely.
Lots of interesting things, as simple as it is, and can be taken on the surface for, you know, a morbid thought, but it's not necessarily.
No, it isn't. And there is many, many religious traditions have some version of the teaching that says your life, as you know it, is always almost over. So it's always time to think about what you wish you had done better, because right now you still have time to do it. But by the time, you know, at some point, you're not going to have time to change things anymore. So why not realize the imminence of the end while you still have time to say a creative response to it and an imaginative response to the end?
Yeah. Right. Have you got another one on hand that you could follow that one with that might be something you would like to comment on?
Mm. Yes. Well, I have an election poem. There was an absolute flood of poetic responses to the last election. And by golly, we've got another one that we're in the midst of right now. I think many people responded to the last election with the shock of feeling like, oh my goodness, this country has been ripping apart into unintelligible tribes. I had a deep feeling about that. It's funny, I kept having this image of an American flag that was ripping stitch by stitch. And I thought, the way that we use language is so powerful. It's either ripping the flag further or it's stitching it up. We're going to use language to sew this country together, not maybe together again, maybe together for the first time in some ways, or are we going to rip it apart? So this is called Make America Great Again. And I'm hoping that it's putting in a stitch in the right direction. Put on your best shoes. Mine have holes in them. And let's make our country great again. I'm not talking about the election. America has been waiting over 200 years to be better than its citizens, to color outside our color lines, to rise once and for all above our festering hatreds. I'm not talking about the election. It's time to put our ears to the ground and listen to America rehearsing its Declaration of Independence from its loneliness for the frogs that are harder and harder to hear. America wishes it could stop missing them. From the wildness of its fires, from its adolescent passions to screw whatever it can. I'm not talking about the election. The election was America feeling restless, hopeless, achingly bad about the robots running its factories and the opiates writing it prescriptions for how to stop hurting when you know you'll never stop hurting again. The election was America choosing what it never wanted and wanting what it never had. Its hands were busy rigging its systems to broadcast its recurring nightmares as widely as possible in the hopes that those who truly love it will wake it up at last. It's time for us, America's mismatched halves, to make friends in real life, off the internet. It's time for me to put on your shoes and for us to walk, if not together, at least in the same direction, and buy America a beer and get teary about our childhoods and heartbroken about our futures until we're sure 100% that we'll go in the morning to our different jobs with the same throbbing in our heads.
Very appropriate. I think that, to weave the different tribes together again is going to be a difficult type of socializing You've been listening to Joy Ladin reading her fantastic poems. Joy, thank you so much. This is Sound Poetry. It's Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. I am your host, David Gilmore, and thank you, Joy.
Thank you, David.